Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We're Zooming Thursday. Yeah, you know the drill. We now begin our show every day with a fabulous bit of political verse. Skip Tenzer delivers our political verse. I mean, what else does the UNH professor have to do but write political verse at a time when the whole world seems to be melting down? Okay, Dave, hit it.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
He's hunkering down, this lame duck, this president who loves wallowing in muck. Firing and obstructing, transition disrupting, creation confusion, what a schmuck.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the work?
If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. Listen, I get email about you now, Scott. People now know more about Texas. And as a result of what you're teaching them, they're paying attention to what's happening to the attorney general. They're paying attention about Governor Abbott. They're figuring out that movie stars want to run for governor. I mean, it's unbelievable how they go. They never really noticed. And now, in a lot of ways, they're Texas sensitive. So thank you so much.
Well, I think they understand what this part of the country is doing to anchor a certain part of our politics.
I just saw a story that came out just before you came on the air about what happened with the Latino vote, the Hispanic vote in Texas. And they said that they almost renamed it.
I'm laughing. I love how everybody has just discovered this the past couple of weeks.
Well, no.
The Latino vote in Texas is a mystery. Oh, Arnie, did you hear that they're not monolithic?
Oh.
Have there been any stories about that?
No.
Has there been any discussion about how Latinos don't all agree about stuff?
Either do the rest of us. So now that we understand that.
I laugh.
So my question is that now that we understand that.
They don't.
How do you divide the pie? How do you have a conversation with the different groups understanding that there is a bit of consensus here? I mean, here's what I think about the African-American community.
Okay.
They don't know whether you're from Jamaica. They don't know if you're an African-American.
There's no comparison between the African-American community and the Latino community.
No, I understand
There's
that.
None. There's zero.
All right. So wait a second. Listen.
No, the reason I'm laughing, Arnie, is because no one understands this, and all the news stories in the last 2 weeks don't explain it to anyone.
All right. So will you give me five? I've only
covered it for 20 years. Where would you like to start?
Give me sort of the Cliff Notes version of what you've been doing for 20 years. So at least if nothing else, we have some information at our fingertips so we don't roll our eyes when we hear, oh, really, they're not monolithic. So explain to us at least what you think are the highlights of how to understand and dissect this community.
You know, there was this front page story that you saw in the New York Times about the Democrats' problem in Texas now emerging along the Texas border. Yes. And they went on and on about Zapata County and how it went for Trump. And there were conservative commentators saying, this is insane. I can't believe that these folks would vote for a Republican. Well, let's back up for a second. A couple things going on at once, a convergence of things that a bunch of people don't understand. One, the Latino vote, and two, President Trump. President Trump, of course, not a classic Republican, not somebody who is in the mold of Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush or Mitt Romney or any of those people that you think of as Republican classic. And so brings to the table some things that appeal to different groups. I mean, you saw in the industrial Midwest and in the places where you live and you know about the people who have traditionally been the blue collar union type folks who do have it in their DNA to think of their economic interests first, right? Before they think of other things.
Absolutely.
But then layer on top of that, the fact that a lot of these Latinos along the border are people who would think that way. And they would think about the fact that these are, you know, a lot of people who work in oil and gas and have jobs based on that. You saw Trump making the big pitch about oil and gas toward the end of the election. We kept thinking he was talking mostly about Pennsylvania when he was talking about fracking, but he's also talking about people in Texas as well. But layer on top of that Latinos along the Texas border are also people who are pretty culturally conservative. They would say they're pro-life, pro-gun, pro-Jesus, etc. This is the kind of person who is sympathetic to the kind of message that President Trump was putting out there and the kind of arguments that Republicans were putting out there. But the Rio Grande Valley being, you know, the four counties down there along with Zapata County, you know, trending toward President Trump, there are by orders of magnitude more Latinos in Dallas-Fort Worth than in the Rio Grande Valley. There are by orders of magnitude more Latinos in Houston than there are in the Rio Grande Valley. And when you look at the people in Dallas-Fort Worth and Houston who are Latino, they overwhelmingly vote for Democrats. They overwhelmingly are people who are more progressive, more liberal in their politics. There are studies that you can look up, and I can send you some of this stuff. There are studies that have shown that, and this is why I always laugh when the racist, nativist people are so afraid of the Latinos, you know, that they will come in and take over our culture, and we'll have to, it's like we'll all have to live under the Mexican flag or something. It's so ridiculous. The studies show that Latinos are the fastest to assimilate when they move to an area. So if they move to a conservative place like the Texas-Mexico border, or they move to a more progressive place like Austin or San Antonio or Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth or California, they will tend to be more Democratic. That's borne out by the election results in California and in Texas. In Texas, you have Latinos who are a little more conservative, a little more entrepreneurial, a little more business-oriented, and in California, they would be more progressive. I see all these people, and we had a story about this yesterday at QuorumReport.com, just making the point that because of this national narrative, people somehow now have this idea that Latinos cost the Democrats elections down in Texas, which is just not true at all. You do have Republicans who have done some work trying to reach out to this community. I would say this 10 years ago, I'd say it today. Governor Perry did. Governor Abbott did when he first ran for governor. People were asking Governor Abbott back in 2014, why were you spending so much money in the Rio Grande Valley? Why are you spending so much money down in South Texas, which has been a Democratic stronghold? Why were you campaigning down there? Abbott and his team talked about the idea of needing to invest in a new region of the state, you know, for Republicans, invest in that region for the future. And so something that has been left out of all this coverage over the last couple of weeks is that Republicans, including Greg Abbott, have spent millions of dollars down there in South Texas, have done a lot of campaigning down in South Texas, so talking to these communities about the things that matter to them. Latinos often feel like they are talked at rather than talked to. They're not really listened to about the things that matter to them. You know, how many times have you heard, it's an old axiom, it's a cliche thing, Arnie, to say that in politics you have to meet people where they are? Well, people need to go south of I-10. And they need to talk to folks in South Texas about the things that matter to them and stop thinking about them as either white or Latino or African-American or whatever, and just talk to people about what matters to them. You've heard it a million times. Demographics is destiny. It's not true. People have to stop saying that and stop thinking that. Demographics is opportunity. When people who are coming along who are different in whatever ways, whether it be ethnically or culturally or, you know, politically or whatever, go engage them in a conversation. Talk to them. Find common ground with them. On election night in Texas, as the returns were coming in from South Texas, I was getting text messages from some of my Latino friends who immediately said, once again, Democrats in Texas take the Latino vote completely for granted, and Republicans have really been working it to their credit. And so the fact is, you have to really do some real work. You can't just go in there and talk to people when it's campaign season. Some of the most effective organizing of Latino communities has happened in places like the Houston area, for example, where the Texas Organizing Project was just kind of an offshoot of some of the Obama stuff from the 2008 years. They would go in and they would talk to people in these communities about what matters in their areas, and they would organize at, you know, Pasadena City Hall in Harris County, for example, about where the bus routes go and where the bus stops are, because that's what matters. People need to be able to get to work. And so when they would be engaged with people at that level, and have talked to them about the things that matter in their neighborhood, then when it comes time for a Texas House race, or for a U.S. Senate race, or for a governor's race, those people who helped me fix the bus routes in my community, maybe I would want to work with them on some other things as well. But nobody thinks of it that way. They think that they can put some Selena music in the background of a DNC ad and play it in South Texas, and that's going to be good enough, and that's not how it works.
So real quickly, you made some comments.
You can't just drink Tecate and think that you know all and think that you can relate to Mexicans.
So I actually wish you'd read a piece in the New York Times with what you just said, that demographics is not destiny. Demographics is opportunity. That is probably one of the most eloquent and, I think, on point conversations we need to have about everyone, about the, quote, the youth vote, the African-American vote, the Hispanic vote, the Asian vote. And again, changing demographics is opportunity to have a conversation, to introduce yourself, to talk about the granular stuff. And let me just say one thing, Scott, because it sort of scared me. When I ran for governor, you know what demographic I lost? I lost women my age. I didn't lose younger women. I didn't lose older women. I lost women between the ages of 35 and 50. Do you know why? Because I was talking about tax reform and that we needed to shift from a property tax to more of an income tax to fund our schools and to fund our services.
They didn't like
that. These were women in the demographic that were finally making money. All right? They were actually seeing salaries that were reaching close to the six figures. And all of a sudden, from their economic perspective, I was talking about taking a piece of what they had just finally accomplished and using it to invest in government as opposed to a piece of property. And that was the demographic I lost. Blow me away with a feather. It never even occurred to me. Here I saw the opportunity of women, but I didn't realize that they too were not monolithic. And the group I lost was the group that was my age. Oh my God.
Yeah, people don't take the time to listen to folks and understand what their issues are on the Latino and Hispanic community. And again, of course, those are not completely interchangeable, but a lot of politicians tend to think that all they need to do is say the right things about immigration and that'll do it. That's not the first issue for most Latinos. One Republican state senator, a senior state senator, explained it to me years ago from his perspective and said, you know, the problem for Republicans is on the immigration issue is that we as Republicans talk about it in a way that is it's like a block. It blocks us out from being able to talk to them about the other things that they care about, because Republicans will talk about it in a way that sounds racist and xenophobic, and we want to kick your grandma out of Houston and send her back to Mexico and all this sort of stuff. So you show up to a conversation insulting people and their families instead of talking to them about the things that they do want to talk to you about, which are the economy, jobs, public education. They want to talk about women's reproductive rights, and where they are on that. You know, they're not all in agreement about that, about what regulations should be there. But when you start out by, you know, insulting people or offending them without even thinking about it or knowing about it, which you did in an economic way in your argument that you're talking about, then you don't get to talk to them about the other things that also matter to them. It's a lot more about listening than it is about talking. And I've told a lot of folks that when it comes to trying to understand the Latino vote, I've spent a lot more time listening than I have talking about it. And that's been over the course of about two decades.
Well, thank you so much for giving us a brief lesson on understanding the Latino vote.
I also, with some humor, will say that there are, you know, plenty of people in Texas who find it funny that I'm considered an expert on this when I am as white as a bedsheet.
Well, but your life is not. So let's.
I grew up south of I-10, Arnie.
I know. That's what I'm telling people. You know, also, geography is opportunity as well.
Sure.
All right. So there are two stories I want to talk about. One is the AP reports that the FBI is now investigating Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton for allegations of corruption and abuse of office, as basically informed by former top staffers. Doesn't Ken Paxton have to be terrified? Because now what we have is a changing administration. Biden is going to be in office. Biden is going to basically say to people, you know, I'm not supposed to get involved with what's happening when it comes to investigations and the Justice Department. You go where you see the story. You go where the corruption happens. In some ways, they now have a license where Donald Trump tried to rein it in and you could hide behind Trump. You're not going to have a situation where that is not going to be possible with the Joe Biden. Isn't Ken Paxton a little bit nervous?
You would have to think so. Now, the Department of Justice, of course, is supposed to be even-handed, but I guess you could maybe make the assumption that a Biden administration, DOJ, would be a little more quick to act on a Republican attorney general who has been accused by his conservative former top staff of abuse of office, corruption, of having an affair. In the midst of all this, and, you know, we should explain here, Arnie.
I'm not suggesting that Biden will be quick to act because he's a Democrat. I'm suggesting he will allow them to act, where Donald Trump...
That's the point. Well, that's the point, to take the foot off the brake. The car moves a lot quicker that way. But look, Paxton was defiant. He sent a statement to the Austin American Statesman a couple of days ago, the newspaper here in Austin. And he said, quote, I make no apologies for being a fierce investigator and defender of individual rights in the face of potentially unreasonable and authoritarian actions. Doing so is not favoritism. It's doing what the people of Texas expect from every law enforcement agency, their attorney general, and the staff of this office. Let me explain what he's talking about. So there is a big real estate investor in Austin, a guy named Nate Paul. And you know how these scandals always go, Arnie. There's so many details and different people who are involved. You almost need a cork board with the faces on the board, and you can put the yarn, strings of yarn between the faces. This guy, Nate Paul, is accused, he and Paxton are accused of having an improper relationship. Paul has been somebody who contributed to Paxton's campaigns in the past and apparently hired a woman or was able to line up a job for a woman who is alleged to have been having an affair with Ken Paxton. Paxton, who's married to a state senator, Angela Paxton, from Collin County, Texas, is accused of having this affair and trying to get a job lined up for his mistress. I mean, it's as simple as that. But Paxton, as you know, has already been under indictment, felony indictment for securities fraud violations alleged 5 years ago. So that's been going on in the background. Now, you might have thought that Republican leadership around here would have cut him loose already, but I do think, and I heard this from a lot of people over the last couple of weeks, Arnie, after the election, that once Republicans struck back here in 2020 and they held the line pretty much on everything in Texas, so, you know, you didn't see any change in the congressional delegation, no change in the state legislature, no change at the statewide level. And in fact, even though President Trump performed worse than he even did in 2016, it was a 6-point race in Texas instead of a 9-point race. The baseline for Republicans statewide is still about 10 points because that was the margin of victory for Senator John Cornyn and other statewide elected officials this cycle. So out of that, perhaps what Republicans have learned around here is they can continue to get away with this sort of stuff, or at least get away with not really saying anything, calling on the attorney general to quit. Now, in the meantime, things may get much worse for him, as you said. The FBI is reportedly investigating. It was the Associated Press earlier in the week that had confirmed that from two unnamed sources. The sharks are circling the attorney general now, and he is said to not be backing down. Now, why would he not back down? In these federal prosecutions of office holders, it is often the case, because they hold a constitutional office, which Paxton does, that could be a bargaining chip during any kind of a prosecution. The fact is, you can't just make them quit. But we've seen this in the past where somebody who holds one of these offices will step aside, agree to leave the office if their sentence is lighter. You know, maybe they get 1 year in the federal pen instead of six or something like that. And when the feds come after you, Arnie, we've seen this over and over again. The conviction rate for a federal prosecution is somewhere around 99%. They don't indict somebody unless they've got the goods. And of course, the federal government brings unlimited resources whenever they're prosecuting somebody. I've only covered one person in Texas politics who was indicted by the feds and went to trial and did not get convicted and is still in office. Wow. And that was a county commissioner in Dallas County. His name is John Wiley Price. He's a fascinating guy. We're going to see where this goes. But the political implications here could be that the governor might get to hand select two candidates for statewide office going into the 2022 cycle. Let me explain that. If Paxton does step aside, let's say he gets convicted or he cuts a deal or whatever, and he has to leave office, then it is the governor who gets to appoint the new attorney general. And there is some chatter that he might choose a state Supreme Court justice. One of the names that's been floated is Justice Eva Guzman, a Republican, a Latina, business-minded Republican Latina would be an attractive candidate statewide. And if he chooses a state Supreme Court justice, then he gets to pick their replacement on the court as well. And that person would be up for re-election or up for election in 2022. So the governor would get to pick part of his slate going into the next round of elections.
Well, actually, and what the governor is also doing is laying a foundation to run for president, because obviously he has an interest in doing that as well. So by picking a Latina from the state Supreme Court, not only does he sort of telegraph a message to what you were just talking about, the opportunity that exists, and he will actually be both showing a woman as well as someone that is Latina. And he's also, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's a strategy for Texas, but it's also a strategy for sort of selling himself nationally. So I think that that's really, really fascinating. I want to quickly, though, go to something that I think is fascinating. Bipartisan calls now for Texas to ditch standardized testing this school year. This actually reflects something I have been talking a lot about, Scott. I keep saying this is not 10th grade or 7th grade or 8th grade. This is the COVID year. It is not a regular academic year. Therefore, the expectation of regular academics, including standardized testing, should go out the window. And on everybody's transcript, it should say the COVID year. And to a large extent, that's what this is suggesting.
Republicans at the national level and at the statewide level in Texas have been resisting this idea that the standardized test should be done away with for the school year. But there's a bipartisan group, nearly a majority of Texas House members, who signed a letter in the last couple of days asking that for right now, Texas request waivers necessary from the federal government to be able to do away with the standardized testing or just use it as a diagnostic. Let me read part of the letter to you. And this was spearheaded by a Democratic representative from San Antonio. His name is Diego Bernal, quote, "We are writing to request that for the 2020-2021 school year, the Texas Education Agency seek the waivers necessary from the United States Department of Education for federal testing and accountability requirements to cancel the administration of the State of Texas Assessment of Academic Readiness, that is the STAR exam. At most, any administration of the exam during this school year should only serve as a diagnostic instrument to see where our students stand academically, as opposed to an assessment instrument to determine," here's the key, Arnie, "to determine district and campus sanctions under the current A through F accountability system," unquote. The State of Texas for the campuses as schools has ratings of, you know, this school has an A, this school has an F, this school has a D, this school has a B. And so to go in, and that impacts their funding. Mm-hmm. That's the key. And so once again, in education, it comes down to this idea that there are those who want to punish these schools when the students don't do well. The counter argument, of course, would be if the students aren't doing well, the very thing that they need is more resources.
Okay, so let me just ask a question. So have all your schools been meeting in person, or have a lot of them been making the opportunity to look remote or to do bifurcated, half remote, half in person? Because again, if you're going to assess a school that is internet challenged, that is low income, that doesn't have access to the kind of computers you need in order to Zoom classes, frankly, what it should be done is an assessment of what is actually needed to support these schools, as you were saying, but not just support them academically, but to support them with the kind of equipment they need and the kind of connectivity they need. That's really what this may ultimately tell us, because we know that wealthy school districts are not only having the chance to meet in person, they have better air circulation, but guess what? They also have access to all the sort of equipment these students need to be able to have a successful online education opportunity.
Yeah, we've got a mix of students who are in person and online. And of course, around the state, things could not be less equitable. The state constitution calls for equity across all of the school districts, more than 1,000 school districts in Texas. But I can tell you that the resources available to folks in Highland Park, which is in Dallas and one of the wealthiest areas of the state, versus people who are in East El Paso County, one of the poorest parts of the state, are very different. And to the point about connectivity, Texas is one of the few states that does not have its own broadband plan, which is something that a bipartisan group of lawmakers, I think a majority of Texas House members, had called on the governor to begin at least the process of getting a broadband plan, because we have many parts of across a state of 30 million people in 254 counties. We have a lot of places where broadband is not readily available.
So I want to end with my version of Access Hollywood.
Uh-oh.
And that is Matthew McConaughey toys with running for Texas governor, while Abbott doesn't foreclose on the possibility of running for president in 2024. Is that real? Is that real? Or is that just something to, you know, go up and down the flagpole? Because he looks at Donald Trump and says, hey, if he can do The Apprentice, I've got better name recognition than Donald Trump. Maybe I can do this in Texas.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, Ronald Reagan, Jesse Ventura, Donald Trump. It's not like, you know, fame and fortune never led to the presidency or to a governorship. He was asked about it. McConaughey was asked about it by Hugh Hewitt, the conservative radio talk show host. He had him on his show, and they had a fun conversation. And Hewitt was just sort of, you know, throwing in some political questions at the end. You know, McConaughey's been going around selling a new book. It's a New York Times bestseller. I will say this. If you listen to the interview with McConaughey when he's asked about whether he would run for office, whether he, you know, would have certain ideas that might resonate with Republicans and Democrats alike, I thought Hewitt did a nice job of talking to him in a bipartisan sort of way. And McConaughey had said that, you know, his own politics, he feels sort of center-right, which led Hewitt to say, well, couldn't you be the governor of Texas then? That's where you're from. So some folks immediately said, well, remember that time that he played bongos naked outside of his house in Austin? That might come up. Although I think in Travis County, that's probably a plus. If you listen to the interview, one thing that McConaughey does very well, and there's no reason he shouldn't be a politician, is he can say a whole lot of words, Arnie, but he didn't really say anything when he's done.
He's gifted.
He's got that gift.
So, you know, what's really interesting is you were going through all the different people who have been actors who have run for, you know, president or governor or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They're all Republicans.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
It's not the Hollywood liberals who are running. Well, they're the ones who want to keep on being Hollywood liberals, but Republicans are the activists.
It's actually that you don't value portfolios. Having an elected portfolio is nothing to sort of, you know, you don't want experience. What? No experience? You're perfect for this position. And on that note, we will not be talking to Scott Braddock, whose birthday, by the way, is next week. One because it's Thanksgiving, one because it's our birthday present, And we'll be joining him sometime in December after he takes some time off from this grueling, grueling political year. Stay healthy. Happy birthday. And I look forward to chatting with you sometime in December.
Thanks, Arnie. We'll talk to you soon. Happy Thanksgiving.
All right, you too. All right, everyone. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
64 years after its invention in 1953, WD-40 can be found in 4 out of 5 American homes. Sure, it loosens and lubricates, but what else can it do? Removes grease and oil stains on clothes, softens new baseball gloves, cleans chrome fixtures in bathrooms, makes the puck side faster on an air hockey table, cleans and softens paintbrushes, cleans and protects cowboy boots, removes crayon from walls, carpet, wallpaper, plastics, shoes, toys, chalkboard, television screens, screen doors, and rock walls. Eases arthritis pain, just sprayed on the joint that hurts. Cleans piano keys, removes super strong glue from fingers, keeps wicker chairs from squeaking, removes scuff marks from ceramic floors, cleans and protects copper pots and pans, polishes and shines seashells, removes water spots from mirrors, removes tea stains from countertops, keeps pigeons off window ledges, they hate the smell, keeps metal wind chimes rust-free, prevents mildew growth on outdoor fountains, removes gunk from plastic dish drainers, cleans dog dew from tennis shoes, removes tomato stains from clothing, gets ink stains out of leather, removes roller skate marks from kitchen floors, removes tar from shoes, and cleans silver plates and trays. And when John Glenn circled the Earth in 1962, his spacecraft Friendship 7 was slathered in WD-40 from top to bottom. NASA engineers hoped it would reduce friction upon re-entry. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
Have you heard it on the news about this fascist group thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land. Don't just sit there on your ass and look that funky chain dance. Brother, sister, shoot your best. We don't need this fascist group thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing.
History will repeat itself. Crisis point, we're near the hour. Counterforce will do no good. Pop you as I feel your power. Hitler proves that funky stuff. It's not for you and me, girl.
No, 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 no.
Europe's an unhappy land. They've had their fascist group thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing.
Democrats are out of power across that blue wide ocean. Reagan's president-elect, fascist got in motion. Generals tell him what to do. Stop your good time dancing. Train their guns on me and you. Fascist gang advancing. Sisters, brothers, lend a hand. Increase our population. Grab that good thing by the throat and throw it in the ocean. You're real tonight, you move my soul. Let's cruise on the dance floor. Come out your house and dance your dance. Shake that fascist groove pain.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove pain. Brothers,
sisters. We don't need nobody's groovy. Brothers, sisters. We don't need nobody's groovy. Brothers.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. If it's Friday, it must be Bill Curry. Bill Curry ran for the governor of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He was very active in the nuclear freeze movement. He writes for Salon.com, but he is a prolific thinker, progressive, informed. And I have to say this, you have an amazing moral compass. And that's one of the reasons why I so value having you on the air. Bill, someone sent me a story. He said, this, Arnie, Leonard Pitts writes so well. I said, no, it's not that he writes so well. Look what he's writing about. I'm going to take this opportunity to share a couple of paragraphs from Leonard's piece. You had the opportunity to actually see the interview with this nurse, so you truly know this maybe even better than I do just from the writing that I read. And here's how he begins. The American death toll from the novel coronavirus will soon pass 250,000. That's a quarter of a million people lying with a Buick parked on their chests, swimming in their own sweat, feeble as an August breeze, head pounding like a bass drum in the devil's rock band dying. And for some, denying it to the end. As Jody Doring, an ER nurse in Woonsocket, South Dakota, puts it, their last dying words are, "This can't be happening. It's not real." And when they should be spending time, FaceTime with their families, she adds. They're filled with anger and hatred. I just can't believe that those are going to be their last thoughts, their last words. Doring, who was explaining to CNN's Alyssa Camerato how she came to pen the tweet that made a small town nurse internet famous. It was Saturday. She had the night off and was planning to spend it on her couch with her dog and some ice cream, but work kept intruding on her thoughts. Can't help but think of the COVID patients these last few days, she tweeted. The ones that stick out are those that still don't believe the virus is real. The ones who scream at you for a magic medicine and that Joe Biden is going to ruin the USA. All while gasping for breath. They tell you there must be another reason they're sick. They call you names. They ask why you have to wear all that stuff because they don't have COVID, because COVID is not real. She says patients insist they must have pneumonia. They must have lung cancer. Anything but the disease they've been convinced does not exist. This can't be happening, they insist, even as it's happening. It's not real. That level of denial is disheartening and appalling. Oh my God, Bill. Oh my God, Bill. I was shaking as I read this article. Because they hug their guns because they're such supporters of the Second Amendment. But what they don't realize is they're firing COVID-19. That's their bullet. Their bullet is COVID-19, and they deny it.
It's of a piece with so much else about the truth. The truth is an even greater crisis than the democracy. I blame, again, the far right and also particularly the evangelical right. If God wants to take me now, he'll take me, say everybody going to the super spreader events and ensuring that God may take not only them, but others who weren't part of the deal. Only God can affect climate. You know, you actually hear this a lot. God's in charge of reproduction. God didn't mean to make any gay people. The list of sins, if you will, goes on, their sins goes on quite a bit. God doesn't believe in evolution, which means he also doesn't believe in physics, which means he doesn't believe in our entire theory of the universe that we live in and the stuff that gives us, you know, GPS and a thousand other things that we use every day. And so it's a culture sinking into superstition. It's not what I used to think it was, 10%, maybe a quarter. It's close to half.
Yes.
And that's been the dark lesson of the last election. I have a friend, a congressman in Connecticut who represents Eastern Shore of Connecticut, and he was meeting with lobstermen all the lobster have migrated out. Lobsters have been leaving because of the warmer waters. They're even leaving Maine more slowly, but they've been pretty much cleaned out. And he was talking to people who'd lost their livings. And he asked them if they thought it had anything to do with climate change. And they said, nope. And so they were speculating that there might be some unidentified pollution in Long Island Sound. They left Rhode Island. They're leaving Massachusetts. And we monitor Long Island Sound pretty closely. We have this other theory, however, that over 98% of all scientists in the world subscribe to, which says that the problem is that your water got too warm for them. They're lobsters. They're famously cold water. And these were the lobster men, and they were down and out, and they weren't buying it. We have to live with this. We have to remember all the time, though. One, I liked that story, and I liked listening, as sad as it was, to that nurse. It reminds me to have sympathy with the people who are so deranged. I felt sympathy for the nurse for living with it, but I felt deep sympathy for the woman who died in that denial and for what it cost her. And I also know, secondly, though, it's an example of the fact that some people aren't coming back. We need to continue to think, in my opinion, about consensus politics. We need to struggle to find genuine consensus politics, not the donor-driven, lobby-driven, poster-driven Washington Center, but the real American Center, which is, on most of the issues I care about, quite progressive. So that means we have to make some compromises and understand and answer some hard questions about the things we're proposing. But it also means we have to realize a consensus in America is never big. The most anybody running for president ever got in America was 61% of the vote. It helps me to think of the consensus we're trying to build as around 60%. That's what I'm shooting for. And Biden just got 51. And I think one out of every five of the others is gettable in the long run. And if we get even 2 or 3% more, we govern for a decade. And if we get 10% more, we govern for a generation. When we think about who we're going to talk to and how we're going to talk to them, thinking of that story of that nurse and that patient is very helpful. One, respect the people who are going down with this. And two, at the same time, remember, even on their deathbeds, some of them aren't coming over. We have to find the people whose minds are still open.
I was beside myself. So I both tweeted it out and I Facebooked it. And I just want to share a little bit of what I wrote. And then I want to sort of explain to you why I wrote it this way. I wrote, the level of selfishness in this country is astounding. You won't wear an effing mask or social distance. The result? You destroy so much more than family and friends. You break our healthcare system. Donald Trump isn't a one-off. He's mirrored in the lives of millions of Americans who believe they have a right to hug their gun and fire the COVID virus. Now, the reason I say this is, and you mentioned about the evangelical community and how they have also sort of set us up to embrace this denial, to not question, to not open up. You know, it's okay if I die. You know, it was God's will. This is interesting. I was raised in a Jewish Catholic environment. Okay, that's how I was raised on Long Island. All right. I was neither Jewish or Catholic. I was raised as a Protestant, but I was the only Protestant kid in my class. Okay. So trust me, when the Hebrew school happened, half the class disappeared, or three quarters of the class. And then all the other kids went to like catechism. So I was like, you know, miserable because I was alone. But one of the things I actually valued about Judaism is that they teach something that I think is really important. And I want my Christian friends to hear it. And that is, you make your heaven here. You make your heaven here. And that means that you are a good steward of the planet. That means that you embrace the science if it's going to protect you and your family and your friends. And the idea that it's God's will takes responsibility off of you to make it better now. Now for your community, now for your country, now for your planet. I so valued the idea of making your heaven here because it puts a burden of responsibility on me. Republicans always talk about the fact, oh, good, Arnie, you understand individual responsibility. Well, you know what? Individual responsibility means I look beyond me to protect things around me in order to protect me. And that's what this story just so screamed at, was they're blaming Joe Biden. They were in denial of their illness. They didn't even recognize or refuse to acknowledge they might have hurt family and friends. And that's because it's okay. You're going to get a pass in the second life, but this is the life you live. How do you not make it better now?
There's a wonderful writer named Stephen Mitchell, who's published the translations of the Tao Te Ching and the Vedas and various spiritual texts. He did the New Testament in a book called, which I heartily recommend, called The Gospel According to Jesus. What he does is he takes everything out that he feels was false, layered in later by people with agendas to push, and tries to produce what is the very essence of it. And it's a wonderful thing. And of course, what the very essence of the New Testament is endless stories of unconditional love and forgiveness and inclusion. And it doesn't matter if you're a Samaritan or a tax collector or a prostitute or a leper or a Roman soldier, everybody gets in, everybody gets forgiven, everybody gets loved. And Stephen Mitchell at some point at least makes the argument, as I recall, that the kingdom of God is at hand meant exactly that. Not that the apocalypse was coming in 10 years, but that the kingdom of God is what is right in front of you and that you're already in. Wake up. And there is something here. The people who've joined forces, I don't want to talk about all evangelicals this way. I'm related to a bunch, and they're not all reactionary. And even the ones who voted for Trump, you know, I have relatives who did, and I love them deeply. I know I wasn't put here to separate out the sheep from the goats, okay? So the evangelicals who became so political, the Franklin Grahams and the Falwells and all these people, they have done to Christianity what the Trumps themselves have done to democracy.
Yes.
They have ransacked it. They have clawed out its meaning. They have disemboweled it of its core meaning, and they have sullied its reputation. One of the reasons that the Southern Baptist Convention pulled back from political involvement beginning about 10 years ago, actually voted out the national leadership who were most politically involved and voted in some people ready to be more nonpartisan. They had lots of good reasons for doing that, but one very self-interested reason was they could no longer fill the pews with young people. Young people were no longer coming to Christian churches for healing and guidance and vision. It would be nice, as everyone who claims to care about capitalism, democracy, Christianity, took a hard look at the reputation and fortunes of all three and saw that peddling a combination of superstition and mean-spiritedness will kill all of them.
I didn't realize I'd be going off in this direction, but I was just shaking as I was reading that story, and you got to hear the nurse tell her story. We have to talk about it. We have to put it in a bigger perspective so we can begin to try to understand it. I can't help but tell you, sort of makes me want to go to the next topic. And you used the word prostitute. And now, unfortunately, I don't want to give prostitutes a bad reputation, but as soon as you said that word, I thought of Rudy Giuliani. And
we don't want to give real prostitutes a bad reputation by associating them with the political prostitutes who are truly deplorable.
Here's what's been interesting. People are asking the question, is it Trump using Rudy or is Rudy using Trump in what he is doing, even though he knows he hasn't been in a courtroom in 30 years? He's embarrassing himself. The judges are rolling their eyes. He's losing. That's not the point of this. It's not a point of knowing or winning or losing or facts or anything. It's a point of delay, raising more questions, mañana, giving time for what you keep suggesting is, which is what Donald Trump wants to do, which is he does want to steal this election. He does want to make it so that there is such question to whether what the result is. And Rudy, winning or losing, just being there is exactly what they both need.
Oh, sure. To talk about their principal pathologies, you don't have to be a psychoanalyst any more than you have to be a botanist to distinguish between a rose and a dandelion. The categories are so clear. I know you remember from high school biology the concept of symbiosis.
Yes.
These guys are working in tandem.
Relationship, and, no question.
And they're both getting a lot out of it would be the simple answer. I just want to diverge for a moment and just say, the Borat movie. I watched the Borat movie. It's not to everyone's taste. I had quite a few laughs. But the piece at the end, even if your sensibilities are too delicate to watch the whole thing through, the piece with Rudy, who was agreed to go up to a hotel room with a woman who looked like she was in high school, then into the bedroom and to have a drink for a supposed interview, and then says that he was lying on the bed with his hand in his crotch because he was tucking in his shirt. I'm old enough to say, just one, number one, that we old men don't get lay down on beds to tuck our shirts in, because getting up out of bed is harder than tucking your shirt in. Nobody does it.
That's a great response.
You know, it's never happened. Not only did Rudy not do that, it's never happened. You can be sure. And of course, if you watch the thing for a minute, it's just clear what he's doing. When shame was a more powerful social force, he would have had to go someplace for a few months and get out of the public eye and figure out how to rehabilitate himself. Nope. He goes from that hotel room with that ostensibly underage woman, actually an actress in her early 20s, and to a federal court to defend the president of the United States in an attempt to overthrow the democracy. I'll say this in two sentences. It is fascism. I talk about this a lot. All the wonderful books, Snyder and On Tyranny, all the great books that came out beginning the Trump administration, told us that we have to wake up and name these things. And yet none of those books, as I recall, actually stopped right then and said, and by the way, an example of fascism is the life you're living right now. And the fascist you have to name is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And again, this isn't like, I'm always uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable with phrases like systemic racism that imply that everybody who supports the system is a racist. At least that's how it's taken by lots of people. Some of whom are racist, many of whom are not. It's a hard thing. And I've spoken on the show a lot about the need to teach morality by example and talk to the white working class with respect and decency and try to get them into a universal progressive program. The biggest ideas we're for, help everyone, and to remind people of that more forcefully. I think that's the mistake Biden made more than any, and the Democrats made more than any in this campaign. But having said that, this is fascism. It is global fascism, like Al-Qaeda and Proud Boys and QAnon. All of these are franchises in which you can have a franchise just by saying you're the franchisee, okay? You can say, I'm the local QAnon person. I'm the local fascist. I'm the local Klan guy. All you have to do is speak up. It's not structured like a hierarchy anywhere in the world right now. We owe it to the people who are being bamboozled to let them know which team they're suiting up for, that its core value is an assault on democracy, that in every instance, it demonizes susceptible, vulnerable minorities. It spreads conspiracy theories and all kinds of misinformation.
But will they believe you? I mean, I want to go back.
Somebody will. You start saying it. Let me just say, if Donald Trump, we live in this bizarro world in which Donald Trump is able to convince half of America that Joe Biden, of all people, is a socialist. And we can't convince people that Donald Trump is a fascist when Biden isn't a socialist. And Trump is a fascist. The Republican Party ran an entire campaign this year about the extremism into which the Democrats were falling, as if AOC were the equivalent of the Proud Boys. It's an outrage. We have to be willing to name the problem. We always have to be willing to name the problem, and we always have to be clear. Calling Donald Trump a populist is because Donald Trump is who? William Jennings Bryan? Are you kidding me? This is fascism. None of the other labels, all of the other labels, misinform and confuse. Every label we use for him is inaccurate. One very available label is accurate. And a few people, Michelle Goldberg in the Times, Stephen Colbert, I see three or four people beginning to say this openly. Yeah. It took us too long in 2016 to ever call Trump a liar. The New York Times, the Washington Post didn't do it till after the election. And we didn't call him a malignant narcissist until his first term. You go through all the main media. And we've been most late with this. Help people understand what's happening here. Being against what Putin's doing is not a revival of the Cold War. It doesn't require more tanks. The problem with Putin is not his tanks, it's his banks and all the corruption that they spew. And it's part of a coordinated effort in countries across the world now to bring down the democracy they despise. And no one has more contempt for democracy in my life that I have met in America. No one has more contempt for democracy than Donald Trump. And that's what we're watching. People who say, there's a wonderful man named John McNeil, who's written the Washington Post a couple of times from Georgetown about how Trump isn't quite a fascist. Neither was Mussolini until he took complete power. The degree to which Trump isn't a fascist is a reflection of the residual strength of our institutions and our culture to inhibit fascism. It is not an example of the limits of his ambition.
Here's the other thing I'm doing as a takeaway. I think it was Pew or someone, they just did this result where they were asking about who won the election, I guess was the question. And 71% of the American people said Joe Biden won the election, except 51%, I think that was the number, I don't have the story in front of me, forgive me folks, of Republicans thought the election was rigged. They agreed that Biden won, but look at how effective Donald Trump has been since 2016, because he's been talking about fraudulent elections even before he won. All right. So, and that has been a theme for the last 4 to 5 years, is that has been coming out of his mouth. What I am trying to figure out is, what does that tell you? That tells you that repetition works, that marketing works, that propaganda works, that if you hear it often and often enough and you're in your little silo, it works. Joe Biden has an opportunity. And I know this is not in his sort of DNA, but I want to know, what is our repetition? What is our marketing? One of the things I said about the vaccines is that I wanted a billboard in North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Oklahoma. And the billboard says that vaccines and science, they're the best example of what we are able to do to save lives and to make a difference. You need vaccines. You need public health. You need science. That's what brought you the vaccines. They didn't come out of air. They weren't a marketing opportunity. It wasn't because Big Pharma woke up one day and said, "Ooh, let's make money on this." First of all, we funded it, number one. So they had every reason to do this. But it's also about science. And as people are going to be lining up to get this, we need to remind them what is saving their lives are people that spend a lot of years of their life working in little scientific labs to come up with something that is 95% effective. And in a lot of ways, you know why I like billboards, Bill? I used this week. I think that what is old is new again. I can't get you to turn off Rush. I can't get you to leave Fox. I know you drive down a road, okay? And that means if I have a freaking billboard in front of your face, and if I buy lots of billboards everywhere that keep saying it and saying it and saying it in different ways, you know what? You're going to see it, and you're going to have to start figuring out how to avert your eyes or maybe look at the reality of your lives, because the vaccine will save your community and save your business.
And we can't allow ourselves to underestimate the power of ideas or the power of the truth. We can't give in to the corporate and right-wing infantilization, the decades-long project of infantilizing the American people. Yes. We still have to talk to them as adults.
Yes.
And we have to keep that respectfully as adults. And we have to answer the legitimate questions of conservatives. How much does it cost? Does it really work? Will you keep me safe? Those are things that every progressive candidate who ever knocked on a door, those are the questions you have to answer in order to get the mental door open to your program. In the larger sense, you know, when 70% of the American people supported Roe v. Wade, which is nearly the number now, but when it started after Roe v. Wade, it was very strong and less controversial, it didn't bother the Republicans that no one agreed with them. And it didn't bother Republicans that they weren't going to win the next year. They take the arguments that they think will eventually triumph or the people they want to please, and they stay with them forever, and they make them every day, and they think about them all the time.
Right.
And we can't even take the Electoral College or public corruption. We are unable to take large issues and abstract issues of any kind and keep the debate going. 32 years after the Boston Harbor and Willie Horton defamations beat Michael Dukakis, 16 years after the Swift voters beat John Kerry, we still don't act as if every charge has to be refuted.
Right.
We still don't act as if our people and our ideas need to be explained. I still watch, you know, Chuck Schumer's. It's almost as hard for me to watch Chuck Schumer as it is to watch a member of the Trump administration. But they get up and they name check progressive issues to mollify the base or hurl a slogan that recently tested well in a focus group, rather than taking the ideas for change that we have and continuously honing and presenting and repeating it. We have to tell the truth as often as they lie. And we have to keep that up, and we don't.
And again, I'm going to remind everyone, you've heard me say this before, when I was at Harvard at the Kennedy School, I used a quote from Bella Abzug, and the quote is actually apocryphal. She said, "You have to lose, lose, lose to win." She did not see a loss, like the Republicans don't see a loss, as an end of a conversation. They just refine it and they come back again. And then they refine it and they come back again. But they repeat it because this is their way of accomplishing what? The win. We lose and we blame. We lose and not see the benefit of what happened as a result of that loss and build on it. We just say, "Ah, okay, walk away." And that is exactly what the Democrats have been doing over and over again. And as you point out, that's why we never deal with corruption. That's why nobody did a perp walk after 2008. That's why Joe Biden says, "I want to look ahead. I don't want to look back."
And the most disturbing thing out of his campaign in the last, since the election, is that statement.
It's the most frightening statement. And I quoted you over and over again, because if we don't deal with the corruption, then guess what? We've told them they have a pass. We told them they can do it again. We told them that there's no consequences for their actions. That is unfair. That's not how I raise my children. That's not how I want my government to act. I need to let you go.
If we make these changes now, these aren't hard. If the party could spend the next few weeks just talking about the differences it has and work on them together, we could apply it in Georgia and win 2 Senate seats.
And on that note, that'll make me smile. Bill Curry, happy Thanksgiving. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be talking to you soon. Thank you.
Same here. Thanks.
All right, everyone. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze next week.